All right, everyone. Next up in this room, we have Cameco with us today from Cameco. Cameco is a stock that we have a buy rating on. Market cap is about $7.4 billion. Our price target is $30. With us today, we have the CFO, Grant Isaacs. Mr. Isaacs is a Senior Vice President and Chief Financial Officer of Cameco. He's based out of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. He joined the company in 2009 as a Senior Vice President of Corporate Services. Previously, Mr. Isaacs served as 3 years as Dean of the Edwards School of Business and 9 years as a professor at the University of Saskatchewan. I'll turn it over to him and let him have, let him tell you the Cameco story.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much. I was just saying that it's never hard to accept an invitation to come to New York, so as always, delighted to be here. I would just like to take an opportunity to introduce some of my colleagues. We've had some changeover in our investor relations group, and so Rochelle Girard is our Director of Investor Relations now, so someone that you'd want to get to know, and she's brought along two of her team members, Corey Koss and Annalisa Govenlock, so, you know, please say hello, and feel free to, you know, talk to them as well and follow up on any questions you might have. I'll pass all questions over to them happily. I would actually throw out a bit of a caution. My slides are different than your handout in front of you. Your handout has many slides in it and lots of information, and rather than rifle through all of that, I've just boiled it down into 5 slides, one on demand, one on supply, one on the near-term issues as we see it, and then Cameco from a financial position and Cameco from a growth strategy point of view. The hope is to get through with a good amount of time for Q&A. These are always more fun when they're interactive, so we'll get to that as well. And probably it's useful for those of you who can't stay very long to start with the conclusions. And the conclusions absolutely won't surprise anybody. They're the same thing every company says when they come through town. One is we believe that the long-term fundamentals in the uranium business remain very favorable. We fundamentally believe that the uranium market is going through a transition from what has been historically a supply-driven market to a demand-driven market. We see a lot of that demand starting to come on in the 2015 period. In fact, the events in Japan, we believe, have created more uncertainty around supply than they have around demand. And that all leads to what we believe is a very favorable long-term fundamental situation for a company like ours. Secondly, no surprise again, we believe that we're very well positioned for that market impact that's coming. We believe our asset base plus the growth strategy that we're on positions us very well to take advantage of those long-term fundamentals. Outside the conclusions, of course, I have to throw up this slide, the happy forward-looking information, and just remind you that this presentation includes assumptions and that actual results may differ materially, and I know you've all read that slide very carefully right away, so we'll go on to the next one. In terms of demand, when I say that the uranium market is transitioning to a demand-driven market, what it's predicated on is this view right here. We look out to 2021 and we see a net new reactor number of around 96. So some reactors are going to close, more are going to come online. We see that changing by 96. 63 of those 96 are already under construction today. We tend to take a little more of a disciplined view on the reactor count. We require reactor programs to be quite a long ways down the path before we count them in our demand view. So 63 of those 96 are already under construction. What we don't have in this, too, is things like the Indian announcement to go to 63 gigawatts by 2030. We don't have that factored in here. This just takes us out to 2021. We don't include in here the Saudi Arabia announcement for 16 reactors. So there are plans outside of this number. This is just simply our view out to 2021. And what we see are a couple of notable things. We see growth coming from regions that are still in the business of baseload. And that creates a different economic proposition than it does for jurisdictions that are thinking about nuclear power as incremental additions to the grid. That's always a tougher sell, especially in environments here with the price of gas. But in jurisdictions where they're still building baseload power, that fundamental 24-hour power in order to have a healthcare system and an education system, transportation, communications, that fundamental industrial power that's needed 24 hours a day, nuclear continues to be a very strong proposition, and we see that in the net new reactor number. This is demand. This is growth that our industry really hasn't seen since the late 60s, early 70s. So it's a pretty exciting time for a company like ours. When we think about this from a run rate point of view, we're moving from, 2011, about 165 million pounds of uranium consumed to about 230 million pounds of uranium consumed a year by 2021 with these 96 net new reactors. There's even reactor programs going on here in the United States with six reactors here. If that's demand, then, of course, always meaningful to talk about supply. More reactors mean more demand for uranium. And when I said earlier that there's more uncertainty around supply than there is around demand, it really pertains to that one box there on the supply side called secondary supplies. What we're seeing is a market that has been very reliant upon secondary supplies, and they're a legacy issue. If you go back to the late 60s, early 70s, there was this concept that nuclear power was too cheap to meter. This idea that there were going to be 1,500, 2,000 reactors around the world. A lot of uranium was discovered. A lot of uranium was mined. A lot of uranium was milled and converted into different forms of uranium fuel equivalent, which we now refer to affectionately as secondary supplies. And those have found their way back into the market over time. So for many years now, primary production has not kept up with demand, and it's been secondary supplies that have filled that gap. And the most notable chunk of secondary supply over the last number of years has been the megatons to megawatts supply, the agreement to downblend Russian-grade military uranium down into commercial use and then bring that back for power production in the United States. If you think about that HEU agreement, highly enriched uranium agreement, in mining terms, which of course we like to do, the HEU agreement, it's 500 metric tons of highly enriched uranium translated into a 400 million pound mine producing 24 million pounds a year. So a mine bigger than MacArthur River, and mine life is up at the end of 2013. So very important source of secondary supply, very visible source of secondary supply leaving the market. We then turn and we look at, okay, well, are there other secondary supplies? Well, there certainly are other secondary supplies available in the market, but we see nothing of the scale and the scope of the HEU agreement. And more importantly, from a pricing point of view, we see nothing that's going to come to the market at a discount like the HEU agreement had did. We see materials that might be available, but sort of in smaller tranches, 500,000 pounds, 1,000,000 pounds on secondary markets, and at a discount to market prices, not at a subsidy, not below the cost of production. So, of course, that then has an impact on the dynamics of the market. So, yes, there'll be other secondary supplies, and if you were looking for a reason why we've entered into an agreement to purchase NuChem Trading. This is a company that really we believe is the best in the world at sourcing those unconventional and secondary supplies. And rather than sort of being victimized by those supplies, we would prefer to participate in that. Our core business is still mining, and it will be mining. But this was an opportunity that we thought made sense given the changing nature of the secondary supply market. Primary production, which is the next block of the supply there, other than the Kazakh story, primary production has been relatively flat in the in Canada, in the United States, in Australia, and even the production that's coming out of Africa is not seeing the growth, certainly, that the Kazakh production has seen. So outside that Kazakh production, there certainly have been some question marks around primary supply. And then, of course, it's also important to remember that a lot of these assets, like the ones in northern Saskatchewan, for example, do take considerable lead time to come online, so the ability to simply get into the uranium business quickly is difficult. And so it's the combination of this demand and supply view as we look ahead that really leads to that conclusion that the market is in a transition. So from a demand side, we see that construction program in China turning into a commissioning phase. 2015, China enters a period where they start commissioning two reactors a quarter for the rest of the decade. Primarily driven from the construction plan they have on right now, but certainly there's other plans in behind there. Our view, 60 to 65 gigawatts in China. So certainly more construction that has to happen from there. We see that happening at a time when the existing customer base also needs to come into the market for long-term supply. So our customers in the United States, our customers in Western Europe, did a lot of contracting through the last price spike, not the 2010 price spike, but the 2007 price spike. A lot of material was contracted on a forward basis. So utilities that find themselves well covered today find themselves increasingly uncovered after 2015 when the new demand hits the market, which is after a very important piece of secondary supply leaves. So we like the way that fundamental is shaping up. And in fact, this is one of those instances where you actually don't have to take my word for it. The data are already there to support it. For those of you who wondered what happened in the summer of 2010, well, it was a very interesting dynamic. The summer of 2010 was when China entered the long-term contracting market. They flipped from contracting some of those first core materials that you need to commission a reactor for their early new build program. They were buying a lot of that material on the spot market because those are one-time volumes. And then in the summer of 2010, which was an interesting turn of events because it's a very civilized process of fuel buying in our industry. It really kicks off in the fall at the World Nuclear Association meeting in London. That sets the supply and demand view. Folks get together. They understand the market. They then start their long-term contracting. It goes through the fall and into the spring. And then things typically go quiet over the summer in our business. The Chinese showed up in the middle of the summer long-term contracting, and you saw the price effect very quickly. A spot price which had bounced in a collar kind of between $40 and $43 for the good part of the year prior found itself $70, and the long-term price, which didn't have the courage to go above $50, found itself in the $74 range all in a six-month period, because this dynamic is real, because fuel buyers recognized that 2015 and beyond period that they were increasingly worried about was the period that the new entrant China showed up and started contracting for. That momentum continued until the events in Japan in Fukushima. So I certainly do want to recognize I certainly don't want to suggest that there is no medium or certainly no near or medium term uncertainty in our market. There absolutely is. I'm telling kind of a long term story, but I don't want to neglect the fact that the near term remains an uncertain period. We did have the earthquake and tsunami in Japan. That marked the end of that run of long term contracting. It was actually a very rational response if you think about it. If you're a fuel buyer and an event like that happens, and you believe that there's now some question marks about the need for uranium in the short term and the possibility that uranium that was otherwise committed is now going to find itself back into the market, you're going to believe that has a downward pressure on price. So you're going to step back to make sure that that downward pressure has been felt before you engage in more long-term contracting discussions. Similarly, producers like Cameco, which did a lot of forward contracting as well through the last price run-up, were heavily committed up to 2016. We stepped back and said, well, this isn't the environment we'd like to be signing long-term contracts in anyway, because we don't believe today's prices are representative of where the market needs to be. So we stepped back, and we saw a period that was characterized by just a heck of a lot of inactivity for the year afterwards, and it really wasn't until the last few market reporting periods where we've seen long-term activity start to pick up again. So in the near term to medium term, we certainly have uncertainty, and I'm not suggesting we don't. There are some dynamics that have to play themselves out. The Japan restart situation has to become more clear. That's going to really set the stage over the next couple of years. In Japan, you know, they're working their way through what I would describe as a three-phase restart model. They're through phase one, which is establish what the stress test is going to look like. They're through phase two, determine who's going to administer the test, and of course that's a regulatory process in Japan of shifting authority from the Ministry of Industry to the Ministry of the Environment. And then number three is determine what a green light means if you go through a stress test. Is that a risk-based decision to restart, or is that just yet another data point that goes in with a bunch of other data points in order to determine whether a restart is possible? So they're working their way through those three phases, and that's taking time. We've certainly seen some rather positive news flow in the last couple of weeks about local councils and local authorities talking about restarts, but ultimately that restart decision is going to come down to real economic pain, an industrial growth model, an export-driven industrial growth model that gets put at risk. It's going to come down to health and safety issues about a hot summer and not the baseload power to support it. And it's going to come down to whether the baseload power is there to rebuild the Fukushima prefecture. So that process has to play itself out before we see the demand there. Interestingly, the feedback we get from our customers is that they want the uranium. They believe their assets are going to come up and be running again. Other pieces of evidence that we follow, we have some Japanese partners in some of our mining projects, and they haven't been interested in parting with their share of those projects at all. In fact, we've seen them wanting to take a deeper dive into some of those projects. So that's an interesting data point. And also in April, we saw some RFPs out for long-term contracts with the Japanese customers. So we remain cautiously optimistic, but there still is a path that we have to go down. Of course, everybody knows about the phase-out plan in Germany. I think it's important to think from our perspective to remember that there's a near-term and a long-term Fukushima effect. The near-term, we spent some time talking about being a very rational period, stepping back, the catalyst has to come back into the market, and that catalyst is that meaningful long-term contracting again, either from the new entrants or from the existing customer base, that existing customer base coming back into the market to start to cover their requirements beyond 2015. There are some rather large utilities the industry just hasn't seen in the long-term contracting business since 2007 in a meaningful way. So that demand will either come from the new entrants or the existing customer base. The longer-term impacts of Fukushima really are supply impacts. You know, it's really the view that you have some inescapable economics happening there. You have demand that's real, 63 of 96 reactors in our count already under construction today, but you see an environment where decisions around future supply are kind of tough to make, especially if they're greenfield decisions or especially if they're large capital decisions that are going to put companies, stretch them a little. And so we see that playing itself out into projects in Africa, for example, a jurisdiction we're not in, but projects that we thought were going to create pounds competing with us 2015 and beyond. We don't see those projects coming to the market in that time frame. I'm thinking in particular about projects in Namibia like the Trekkopje project, which we thought 6 to 8 million pounds a year in that period. Areva has a few other African projects that they've announced are either on hold or on the shelf over this period because the price environment isn't one where you would make those decisions. So we have seen an effect on supply. Certainly that effect on demand is real. If we were talking before Fukushima, we would have said 110 net new reactors by 2021. We're now at 96. So that demand curve has come in a bit. That supply curve that we keep our eye on, and our belief is there's a likelihood it could shift in more than the demand curve, and of course price pressure is up in that environment, not down. So it's those two dynamics that are working themselves out because of the events in Japan. So demand, supply, and the near term I wanted to cover. Wanted to also spend a bit of time talking about us. In 2011, a year where a fairly catastrophic event happens in our industry, we did have a very strong year. We had record annual revenue, record gross profit in our uranium segment, and record average uranium price. This reflects the ability of a company like Cameco to mine our contract portfolio during times of uncertainty. We had customers who would say to us, for example, look, I don't need that material today. I don't have a reactor that's running. I don't need it, but I want the material eventually. And we would say, okay, well, we can talk about deferring that contract, but by the way, we're talking about one of the lower price contracts, and we're talking about moving that material to the end and escalating it throughout the life of that contract, not freezing it at today's, and then taking that material, which may have otherwise been delivered into what we call legacy contracts or older contracts, and placing it in a market that still, by historical standards, is at fairly strong prices. And so we were able to do that throughout the course of 2011, and we'll continue to do that during this time of uncertainty as we transition into what we believe is a demand-driven market. And I will spend a bit of time on this page, given everything we've just said about our performance and our strength, and just briefly comment on prospectus we filed recently on a cross-border mixed debt equity prospectus. And I just want to make the point, think of this as normal course renewal. We're a company that historically has accessed the capital markets through bought deals in Canada, for example. That kind of has been our pathway. But I think on a go-forward basis, we will always have an evergreen prospectus, and it will always be cross-border, and it will always be mixed. And this was just the first tranche of it. And in terms of why timing now, well, coming out of your AGM is when your disclosure record is the cleanest, and it makes the most sense to do it right then. So I just wanted to reference that. Think of it as normal course. Expect that from us through the years, and then kind of think about it from the perspective that certainly we're in an industry that has a lot of uncertainty. Make sure the tool's in the toolbox to deal with that uncertainty. Certainty creates opportunity. Again, make sure the tools are in the toolbox to seize opportunity. And then eventually, at some point, you know, normalcy will return to our industry, and we'll have a better sense what the run rate of the uranium business looks like. And then we'll have a conversation about an optimal capital structure for Cameco, and just to make sure that the tools are in the toolbox for that. So I just want to leave the impression that it's just normal course renewal and expect it on a go-forward basis. So from that, I would just finish off with our growth plans. This is a chart we put out a couple of years ago, and it's neither your eyes nor the lighting in the room. The chart is deliberately blurry. It always has been. It's not hashed along the bottom with specific time references. It was more meant to demonstrate the portfolio that we have of pounds we already own, pounds we already know, that are the basis of our expansion plans. And there's a couple of lessons. One is we very much believe in being a low-cost producer of uranium. So you see a dominance there of pounds that are either in northern Saskatchewan from those high-grade projects, or you see pounds that are coming from Kazakhstan. So very different geology, very different mining type between the two, but overall life of mine operating costs that are very similar, and we believe in that low cost category. And that dominates our project pipeline. And also, you'll see a second point in our project pipeline, and that is we believe the best value creator is brownfield expansion. So as you go up through this list, you have Cigar Lake. Well, Cigar Lake is a project that certainly has received a lot of attention in the past. It's one that we're very pleased with the path that it's on now, but it's a project that benefits from all the existing infrastructure we have in northern Saskatchewan. We want to expand our existing production in the U.S., expand in Kazakhstan, both on blocks 1 and 2, plus a very prospective block 3 that's contiguous to our 1 and 2. In fact, as you go up the list, there's only one true greenfield project in our pipeline, and that's our Kintyre project in Western Australia. Everything else benefits from having infrastructure, workforce development, business development, milling infrastructure that's already there, as well as relationships with regulators and permits and all of that. And that's an important driver for our strategy, that brownfield expansion. So as we go through this portfolio, and I know I'm not supposed to add these numbers up, so I won't, 435 million pounds of proven and probable reserves, 254 million pounds of measured and indicated resources, and 317 million pounds of inferred resources. And if somebody were to add those all up, it's over a billion pounds of reserves and resources. The most dominant of them are around existing infrastructure and associated with what we believe are low-cost projects. So in a nutshell, we believe the long-term fundamentals are very strong for our industry. There still is some near-term uncertainty that has to work itself out, but we believe it's creating as much question mark, if not more, for supply than it is for demand. We like what that means for primary producers when it becomes a true demand-driven industry, and we like our position in that market as being a primary producer with what we think are terrific assets. So with that, I would like to open it up to Q&A.
Back page here, you have a production outlook, and I was just wondering if you could talk about how much of that production is contracted, or how much of that production is contracted to
folks. What we say to folks is that we are heavily committed out to 2016. So a lot of that production is already contracted. And it's contracted according to a contracting strategy that we've had in place for a number of years. It's one that previous leaders in our company said, you know, this is the contracting strategy that we have to have in place. And then we spent some time looking at it empirically, and it discovered that they were right. It does make sense. And it's what we call our 60-40 contracting strategy. So 60% of our contracted portfolio is what we call market-related, and it references either the spot price or the long-term price at time of delivery. So, say, a month before delivery happens, a couple years from now, whatever the prices are that prevail is what's referenced in those market-related contracts. And then 40% of our contract portfolio are fixed-price contracts, and that's really a recognition of the fact that our customers typically have a different incentive than we do. Our customers typically want or have a mandate for more fixed-price contracts than market-related contracts because of the certainty that underlies them. So it's striking that balance between what our customers want and what we want in the market comes to the 60-40. We've thought in the past that does it make sense just to say no to fixed-price contracts? If we believe our story about the long-term fundamentals, then shouldn't everything be market-related? And our view on that is two things. One is that the role of fixed price contract is still pretty big in our market. And if we just said no to those, we'd be walking away from market share, and that wouldn't actually be a very smart thing to do. But secondly, fixed price contracts, really the conversation is around the long-term price indicator, not the spot price indicator. And the negotiations are how you escalate it. So our history is that those fixed price contracts have not been particularly punitive. So that becomes the basis for our contracting strategy. Yeah, the latter, to be opportunistic about opportunities. Oh, sorry, the question about the shelf prospectus, was I talking about having flexibility to deal with perhaps some expenditure surprises or CapEx surprises with our own plans, or to be opportunistic? It was more to be opportunistic, to say uncertainty does breed opportunity and just make sure the tools are in the toolbox. Now, we remain a very disciplined company from an M&A point of view. You haven't seen us make a lot of transactions over the years. Expect that discipline to continue, but we just wanted to make sure the tools were there. And ultimately, when we come out of this period where perhaps some opportunities simply aren't there, we'll then have the tools in the toolbox to go and have a good look at our capital structure as well.
Can you sort of frame what you consider, the target opportunity, not assets, but size or geography, something like that?
Well, if you look at our growth plans, you see a lot of production coming on in 2018, and then production running for, a decade and a half. So really that creates two periods. It creates an M&A focus between now and 2018, and perhaps a focus beyond when you want to sustain at that level of production. So that really becomes the two bookends that we're looking at. Pounds that fall into that period, they just have to be a very good value driver for us to chase them. But, we've said to our corporate development team in the past, a near-term producer or an existing producer would be great. A couple million pounds a year to move the needle for us would be great. Something that produced for a decade or more, consistent with our long-term contract portfolio. Something we could own 100% outright because we don't need to get into any complicated joint ventures. And so, then ultimately show us it's a better economic proposition than brownfield expansion. And so you can imagine what we've effectively done is tied their hands behind their back and shoved them in the ring and told them to go box. I mean, as a result, we haven't really found much that we believe will create that kind of shareholder value we're looking for.
And you'd say mostly in developed jurisdictions?
Well, we have our current CEO, he started in July, before he joined Cameco. He was the executive vice president running all mining projects for Areva. He's got boots on the ground in parts of Africa that a lot of people have never been and can't even pronounce. We've got expertise and interest there, but it's always an economic decision to go in. So not ideological. It's not a determination that, developed countries or developed jurisdictions are always better. It's just at the moment, with our portfolio of pounds, it's the better economic decision.
think that's all the time we have. I could thank Grant and Cameco for coming out.